You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, February 10th, 2016, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Evening, folks.
Hey, Evan. Ev, I wanted to ask you, so tax season is approaching.
Oh, it's here.
And you're an accountant.
Yeah.
You're going nuts, huh?
With a vengeance, it's here. Yeah, you know, I roll with the punches. So you have to work about 90 16-hour days throughout the season.
Oh,
I mean, you
God.
Know, there are people who do worse than that.
Do you ever have people show up with just like, I don't know, like just a massive box just full of paper? And they're like, figure it out.
Yes.
Why?
Yes.
Why are people like that? I use QuickBooks. I'm neurotic about being organized.
Oh yeah, no, I'm certified in QuickBooks, so I can actually help people with that. But when people do show up with just a box, shoebox full of papers and stuff, we'll gladly take it, but we'll also say, "Hey, listen, you can give it to us this way. It'll cost you twice as much for us to do it because
good.
Time is
yeah, it's paying by the hour,
right? Right, exactly. It's by the hour, and however you want to spend your money is fine. Typically, they'll take their shoebox back and do it then, organize it themselves.
Yeah, what they think you were going to sort through that for hours of work just for. Because you're nice guys, I mean.
Evan, is there any pseudoscience in this field?
Well, there's a lot of scams that go on, certainly with people getting calls from the IRS or emails from the IRS. The IRS will never call you. The IRS will never send you an email. So we are constantly trying to warn people about these kinds of scams. And we have several older clients, so they're the ones who sort of fall are the prime victims for those
yeah.
sorts of scams.
Yeah,
and we're constantly reminding them to not fall for that and to report it whenever possible.
That's good to know. You know, I just had a coworker tell me of an incredible scam that I think would be very good to tell our audience. My a coworker of mine, his mother received a phone call from someone pretending to be her grandson, his son, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the guy was like pretending to cry and tried to talk her into sending $2,000 via Western Union because he was on vacation and he got in some trouble and he'll explain everything when he gets home. And Western Union actually asked the grandmother, why are you sending this money? Just to, you know, because I guess they know now that a lot of scams happened through them. And she said, oh, my grandson said this. And they convinced her that it was probably a scam and for them to call the grandson right
wow.
now and make sure that it wasn't a scam. It was a scam.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how we think it, you know, another coworker of mine, you know, we love to learn about these types of scams. We figured out it was very likely that the kid was posting like vacation pictures on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
A scam artist saw that, did some social engineering on Facebook, like, okay, let me see who this guy's friends with, who's this mm-hmm. guy's parents, who's his grandparents. Oh, there's a grandparent. Figures out who the grandparent is, finds the phone number, calls up the grandparent, says, hey, grandma, I'm on vacation, as you know, and I got into some trouble. Can you help me out? Send me this money right away.
Oh, boy.
That's a real – think about the intensity of that scam. It probably isn't
yeah.
as hard as you think it is to get the information.
No, that's probably really easy,
wow.
actually. It sounds crazy, but he could have figured that out in like 30 minutes.
Yeah. I'm so happy my grandparents are dead.
that's
well,
one – That's a glass half full.
And I guess she didn't recognize the voice.
Well, you know,
yeah, right?
First off, it was an old woman who the person was crying on the phone or faking crying,
yeah.
which kind of muddies it up a little bit.
Yeah.
What if they deliberately have a bad connection?
Yeah, you know, you could do that. You can make it so you can't hear so well. You know, just makes it sound more desperate. But you know, I recommend you tell your parents, tell your grandparents, you know, to be cautious of these types of scams. If you get a crazy phone call from me or anyone in the family asking for immediate money through you know a quickie cash service, make a phone call.
Yeah, always make a phone call.
Yep.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Never believe anything anyone says when they call you. Basically, you have to initiate the contact so you can know who you're talking to.
I can't believe Western Union is still around. Like you can just PayPal somebody money.
Mhm.
Yeah,
so weird that like
Western Union is an instant cash transfer cash, right? There is a fee
yeah.
associated, but you could, you know, even with PayPal, there's a delay to get the money.
Gotcha.
Well, that's great that they have a little fraud alert thing built in there.
Yes.
I thought so too, right, Steve? It's
yeah.
just good business for them to try to help protect people. So, because I guess people would come back to them and be like, what the hell, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I want my money back.
Well, we have a great show coming up. We're going to start with What's the Word, Kara?
Yeah.
Yes, we are starting with what's the word. And the word this week was actually submitted by at USC Waller on Twitter. The word is pleochroism. And yes, again, I looked up how to pronounce it because I would say pleochroism.
Me too.
Of course, if you are using it as an adjective, it would be pleochroic. And I'm assuming it's not incorrect to say pleochroism, but most sources online say pleochroism. So listening to that word, any guesses? All right, Bob, well, any guesses of what you think it might mean?
Something to do with light, I would think.
Mm-hmm. From the crowism mm-hmm. aspect of it.
You're right.
Crow. Yeah. So it's
and
a term.
And then rocks.
And rocks. Actually, no rocks in that word. But
I think you're thinking of litho.
But it is true. It is true. It is a word that you often hear in optics and geology, specifically mineralogy.
Rocks. There you go.
Yeah, rocks. There you go. Referring to the property specifically of crystals to exhibit different colors when they're viewed from different directions under light. And notably, you'll see this when the light is polarized. So looking at specific directions of light, the crystal will look one color. And then when you look at the other direction of the wavelengths, it will look a totally different color. So pleochroism comes from the Greek pleo, meaning more, and chros, meaning the color of some sort of exterior coating like a skin. And its first scientific use in the literature was in 1857. And yeah, USC Waller sent this word in because he said that it was his favorite geology word that he's come across. It's a good word.
Yeah, that's cool.
I feel like
that's
I could use it in life. Like I have some nail polishes that when you look at them under different lights, they sometimes look green and sometimes look purple. Pleochroic mm-hmm. nails there.
Cool. Yeah.
Mm. I want to try and work it into my daily vocabulary.
What is these on a molecular level? Like, do we know what the mechanism of that is?
It has to do with double refraction. So because of the actual structure of the crystal, when the, you know, just like in a prism, light will pass through and it'll like break it into different wavelengths. In a crystal that exhibits this double refraction property, it splits the light into two different polarized components. There's an ordinary ray that comes out of it, and then there's an extraordinary ray, which I love that that's what it's called. And they come out in perpendicular planes. So, you know, there are different substances like dichroic substances that only transmit one type of ray, but pleochroic substances transmit both. And so if you use a polarizing filter over your light, you'll see two different colors. Yeah, that's really, really interesting. Cool.
That is.
Oh.
Let's go on to some news items. Bob, you're going to tell us about a robotic chef.
Ooh, sounds like the chef of the future.
This is very George Jetson, this whole thing.
It totally is. It actually had an effect on me that doesn't happen very often, but you ever read something, some new science or technology, and you just kind of involuntarily like laugh? Is that just like a weird thing that?
Yeah, Bob, that's called going crazy.
Yeah, well, I was giggling like a little kid because this is just so damn cool. Basically, the video I saw, it showed a kitchen module that has everything that you need to create almost any meal using two robotic arms with hands, of course, that rival human dexterity. They're incredible hands. No humans required. And the consumer version, it will be available not in 5 years, but they're saying next year, 2017, they're gonna have a consumer model of this. It's funny how I got very excited and also very, very frustrated because I was kind of pissed that I didn't anticipate this. It just made perfect sense to me that at this point in robotics development that they would have something like this. So it started with computer scientist Mark Olejnik. He's the founder of the Moly company that's producing this, and he worked with Shadow Robot Company. How cool is that name? Shadow Robot Company to come up with these robot hands. Now, Shadow Robot, they've been working on this kind of development for like two decades. They've got research and development on this, coming out of their whatevers, and they actually supplied NASA with the robot hands for their Robonaut program. These hands are used, or hands very much like them, are used in labs, scientific labs, and the hands are amazing. They've got 20 motors, 24 joints, and 129 sensors, and they really can do pretty much anything that, that any chef can do in making a meal. Now, but the basic unit though is a kitchen module. It's an entire module, not just these hands, which is portable. They could pretty much make it, you know, they could fit it into most, you know, many different types of kitchens. And it includes things like a stovetop, an oven, sink, utensils, and even some accounts say that it even comes with a fridge. And of course, it also has a touchscreen. So you could actually say, hey, make this for this many people. And you could also use your phone, of course. It'll have an app where you could just like from work or even from your bed in the morning, just like say, make me this. Now, what they're doing is that they're going to create, when you buy this thing, when you buy it, it'll have 2,000 recipes available in this iTunes-like setup. Some of those recipes were made by master chefs, including BBC Master Chef winner Tim Anderson. And this kind of leads into, I think, is one of the greatest innovations of this device, is that they've got 3D mapping. Now, Anderson didn't just hand over his recipes and somebody coded it into the computer. He had special gloves so that the system could map him in 3D every move he made, every nuance. And if he picked his nose, they caught it with perfect fidelity. And the robot arms can perfectly replicate his moves. He was a little skeptical. He 3D mapped him making a very specific dish to see what the robot would do. So he said, to be honest, I didn't think this was possible. I chose crab bisque as a dish because it's a real challenge for a human chef to make very well. Never mind a machine. Having seen and tasted the results for myself, I am stunned. This is the beginning of something really significant, a whole new opportunity for producing good food and for people to explore the world's cuisines. It's very exciting. So that's what a master chef said about this. Now, regarding this 3D mapping technology, other famous chefs could map themselves and then they could sell their recipes, you know, make some money off of it. The cool thing is that they could actually have people over the entire planet, people that would never, ever eat their food. Because when you're a big chef like that, you know, you've got your restaurant, you've got your city. And if you don't visit that city and visit his restaurant, you're just never going to have his food. But with this, he could spread his, you know, his recipes throughout the entire planet. The commercial version is going to have, will let anybody 3D map themselves. So you can record family recipes and share them with anyone they want. So Jay, Steve, you know we'd have Dad making meatballs and lasagna and stuff, mm-hmm. and we'd just totally record that, and we'd have that for posterity. Now, the demo version that you may see on the internet doesn't have optics, so the ingredients have to be in very precise predetermined locations, which is a little bit annoying. But it's, you know, so what?
I don't think that's a little bit annoying. I mean, that's a pretty significant limitation. You have to absolutely precisely place your ingredients in order for it to work. I mean, come on. You just can't, like...
Yeah.
Well, okay, yeah.
Because it's just... There's no optics. It's not interacting with the ingredients. It's just going through predetermined emotions.
All right, I'll give you that's annoying. But
also,
but
if something's a little off, it just keeps doing what it's doing, even if it's throwing food all over the place. You know what I mean?
Well, the hand sensors would know what's going on. But Steve, that's the demo version. That's the demo version, people.
Let's say it like it is with Steve, all right? Steve, you talk like that to that robot, it'll ninja slice you before you even turn around.
No. It'll spit in your food.
Actually, Jay, it won't, and I'll tell you why. But no, that's a demo version. The commercial version, the plan is to have, it's going to have appropriate vision so that it's going to recognize the food no matter where it is. And so you are right that's a key advance that it needs. The funny thing is that it's not going to have any knives. It's not programmed to have any knives in it because the company seems to think that people will not want knife wielding robots in their homes. And I guess, which is hilarious.
Come on.
Which is totally hilarious. But I can kind of see that. Although I did see a video of the hands actually using a knife, but I did read that they will not have that.
No, it's funny. Hilarious. Imagine this would be a great murder mystery where somebody programs the hands to stab somebody and kill them.
Yeah.
And so like they think they're going to make lasagna or whatever and they hit the button, but somebody had reprogrammed it, you know, with stabbing motions. There's a slicing motion.
Yeah, right. But Steve, it's like, here's a free lasagna recipe. Upload it into your freaking kitchen robot now. And then it goes into the kitchen robot. The kitchen robot's like, huh.
I will kill them all.
It's funny because it really could do that very easily either, because this thing is like locked down. There's like, it's like inside behind this like sliding glass door thing. Yeah. So even that would be difficult. And the other thing that they do, they actually slow the arms down because to a human speed, because they think people will be freaked out by these really fast, you know, robot arms doing stuff. And that's just hilarious because, you know, we would crank that up to as fast as it'll go. You know,
they have to tailor this thing to our delicate sensibilities. Yes.
Oh, that's a huge field in robotics, is trying to figure out how to make robots not be scary to people. It's like really important.
We are a wimpy race, I tell you.
Bob, most importantly, will it do the damn dishes?
That's the plan.
Nah, we got wives for that.
The plan. Oh wow.
Holy crap. Just kidding, people. Okay. Don't send emails.
And all this can be yours for 5 easy payments of actually the company claims that the commercial robotic kitchen modules will be available in various configurations. They say that the prices will range from $15,000 to $72,000 in 2017 and 2018. So yeah, $72,000, that's a boatload of money, but it's first generation. Really? Yeah. But $15,000, now that's pretty impressive because people will do kitchen upgrades for at least $15,000. That to me, so that's not.
Yeah, but what do you get at the low end?
That's the question. I couldn't find what the various configurations.
You get the optics,
cereal. You get the robots that cry when they cut the onions.
So,
no cutting.
So as cool as that is, and of course, you know, first gen, it doesn't even bother me because you know that price is going to go down. So that's just, you know, whatever. But the real cool thing though is to really consider the ramifications. That's what really kind of got me giggling. The fun is, you know, the fun isn't just that we're going to have these robot chefs and, you know, in the kitchen totally, Jetsons, that's really not it, I don't think. Because if you extrapolate a bit, and of course, you know, I like doing that, it could really be a milestone of sorts. Now, imagine, you know, at some point in the future, 10 or 20 years, you've got thousands or even more families having this. Now, what the makers claim is that because this is making food that you want without you having to really do anything except maybe buy the food, there's going to be less reliance on processed foods, and less reliance on fast food and prepackaged food. So what they're saying is that this could really have an appreciable impact on the general health of the population. You could also do things like you could have your diet completely set up by a nutritionist, or if you're sick, you could have, you know, special individual health needs. So it could really tailor your diet to be more healthful and to be specifically, you know, the kind of things that you need. So that's one of the claims that they make, and it's interesting and it kind of makes sense. Now Moli Robotics is also looking into more household automation, and I was curious to discuss this with you guys. So they're looking for other ways basically for these robot arms and hands. What could they do? So some things that came to mind is that the rail, because, you know, this is on a rail in your kitchen. Now that's a problem. You're not going to have rails all over your house, so that's not going to work. So, but of course you could mount it. You could mount it on something like Roomba or something that's probably bigger, of course. Or we all know how advanced robot legs are these days. I mean, they're just really, Boston Dynamics has got amazing quadruped legs. You've seen Asimo with his amazing bipedal gait. So mounting it on there, it could do things potentially like just picking up your house, making your bed, loading and unloading the dishes. I mean, just a lot of tasks like that. And even if it did just that and nothing else, what a huge help that would be. What do you guys think? What could these do in a house?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because this is that kind of technology where I think it's hard to just sit and think about like how they're going to be utilized. Like even the cooking feature, while we're talking about this, I'm trying to think, yeah, you know, would I have the robot do that? I mean, would it really be worth it? I think like the one situation where it would be helpful would be, imagine if you like can set up the food before you go to work and you time it, you say, all right, start cooking at 5 o'clock or whatever.
Well, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. And then, yeah, you get home at 6 o'clock or 7 o'clock or whatever, and food's all ready for you. One of the reasons, yeah, we have a household with two working parents, it limits, you know, the time that you have to prepare any elaborate meals. We're always looking for meals that we could create very, very quickly because, you know, we get home, children are hungry, you can't start a 2-hour process of cooking right at that point. So that could be useful for that. It also could be very useful for people who are impaired or elderly or whatever, just who need help. You know, it's basically a home health aid. So,
well,
yeah, I mean, I think,
restaurant.
But it's, you know, I think that, again, we don't know what the $15,000 versus the $70,000
right.
versions have, but
right.
is it going to be one of those things where, you know, a lot of people are driving around in $20,000, $30,000 cars. It's going to be the same kind of thing where it's a really expensive appliance that a lot of people will just finance or buy or whatever. It just becomes part of the cost of the home.
Sure, absolutely. I think
yeah,
that
like an
makes
oven.
A lot of sense. Sure. Yeah. Now, but even outside the house, imagine this in restaurants. Imagine a
restaurant.
Imagine
that's yeah. that's the
right,
application.
A big restaurant. Because you one cook or no cooks, you could have 12 right. pairs of these arms and create, you know, a whole mess of 5-star meals or any one of thousands of different meals as long as you have the, you know, the, yeah. the raw product.
And it would be the exact same every
exact.
Time, which is what people want is like
assuming
consistency.
It's not malfunctioning.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, a lot of chefs, you know, very few chefs are like running a restaurant. You know what I mean? That's like the rock star level of chefs. A lot of chefs are spending hours a day chopping vegetables. You know
exactly.
what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Prep, and, kitchen prep.
And you know, so, I see a lot of them as my patients because like they get horrible carpal tunnel syndrome, whatever. It's like the worst possible repetitive motion injury from you know, chopping food. So I could see this in a commercial kitchen doing a lot of the repetitive
grunt work. Yes.
Prep
a lot of
work.
The grunt work. You still have a chef yeah. handling things artistically and whatnot, but you know, you could just have like, this is an assembly line where it's doing all the chopping and a lot of,
sure.
it could be doing a lot of the stuff. Sure. I think that is probably a much more viable application than just having this in your average home.
Right.
Although that, I think that'll come at some point. Just to
oh, for, oh, for sure. And Steve, you, and I mean, I agreed with what you were saying, but the idea is that the cook, not only is it getting rid of the grunt work, he literally wouldn't have to do anything. I mean, once he 3D maps him making that meal, it's in the database. You are done.
Yeah.
And that's one thing I want to stress is that this is not going to do away with cooking in the future. I mean, there are people out there and there's a lot of people out there that not only just love eating and love food, they actually enjoy the process of actually making food. And that's fine. I compare it to driving cars. I remember years ago, 20 years ago, telling my friend, man, I can't wait for automated cars. And he was aghast. He's like, that would be horrible. I absolutely love driving and I would never want to give that up. And I think in the future, people will still be able to drive, you know, not anywhere. I mean, even highways might be kind of out of limits, off limits for people to actually drive themselves. But that doesn't mean you'll never be able to drive anywhere. So it's kind of a loose
analogy. They'll
probably
have a lane. They'll have a human lane and then the automated lanes.
Perhaps. But think about this. How many people do you know love eating compared to how many people do you know actually love and enjoy cooking? I mean, it's not very similar at all. Most
well, I
people-
think it's like driving. It'll probably be that you won't have to cook.
Right.
You can always cook if you want to. Like, I'd like cooking when I have the time.
Weekends. Cook on weekends.
Yeah. And, you know, sometimes I like mm-hmm. experimenting with recipes or whatnot, you know. But I'd say get home after a long day and – You know, having to cook because you have no other options kind of a pain, but it becomes optional. Just like driving, it's like I'm sure people will drive when they feel like it, but it's like, oh, it's late, I'm sleepy, I'll let the car drive me home, you know, or whatever.
Absolutely.
I gotta read, I gotta do something, I'll let the car drive me home because I don't feel like driving right
yeah.
now. But if you feel like driving, yeah, you can put it on manual and take
yeah.
it for a spin.
Or if you love cooking and you're throwing a huge dinner party, sure, do all the upfront work, get a lot of it done. But then when the people start arriving, the robot hands take over and do the last minute stuff or whatever needs to be done while you're mingling with your friends. It could like just do the last little bit so that it frees you up. So you're not in the kitchen while your guests are, you know, in the dining room.
It's a force magnifier too. It's a pair of hands, literally.
Yeah.
And yeah, so you could have it do stuff while you're sort of orchestrating everything.
Right.
But again, it's like, okay, chop up these 5 onions while I do this over here or whatever.
Chop
yeah,
these
yeah,
five
yeah,
humans.
Yeah, there's that too.
And, chop.
And
wait, I said onions, not humans.
And the cool thing is, and it's so much more than just a pair of hands. Like I said, it, this thing could be considered a master chef in its own right once, of course, it's been programmed in. So
oh,
that's
gosh.
Just
and then
amazing.
We're
going to
have like, Food yeah, Network yeah. Shows devoted to the
robots.
Chopped. Robot chopped
Bob,
and stuff.
You're going to be the first person I know that falls in love with a robot.
oh,
Too
you
late.
Guys. You guys.
He's
you,
already there.
You have to check out this... my latest episode on this fusion show I did called Real Future. I shot it last year, but it's just now airing. And there's an episode now out about robot love. And it's fascinating because I went to the Real Doll facility where they make these like robot sex dolls.
Yes.
And they're integrating AI into one of them. And we brought along this guy who was having this like really emotional conversation with this robotic doll. I think he had like strong feelings for her.
Is that healthy?
Talk about
it. Was really interesting.
Is that healthy? I think that's the question.
That's a big question that a lot of people are asking.
Talk about the uncanny sexy valley. Oh my God.
Oh, it's creepy still. They have not, I don't think, crossed that uncanny
valley. I wonder if the uncanny valley is a fetish.
It is. I also interviewed a guy for another show.
It's like necrophilia.
I know. I also interviewed a guy for another show who literally calls the dolls that he's in love with synthetics. And I think he calls real people analogs.
Norms.
Yeah. Yeah. Carbons. It's super weird. Like he's not into analogs that much.
Yeah.
DNAs. Yep. DNAs.
Yeah. Nope.
Okay.
Just bummed you guys.
No. It's interesting. You know, hey, it takes all kinds.
Make love to your kitchen robot.
Exactly.
Got it.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Movement Watches. You guys all got your watch, right?
Oh, yeah.
It's so pretty.
Very, very, very stylish. I got the black with the gold.
Mine is just like yours, Steve. It's a black face with no numbers, gold details, black leather band. It's really nice.
Mine really tells time.
They do that too.
I wore mine at work yesterday. I got compliments on it.
Ooh.
I mean, what better praise is there than that?
Bob, did you know that Movement Watches were founded on the idea that stylish watches don't have to be expensive?
I did not, Jay.
That's for real. If you look at their website, the pricing on the watches is unbelievably reasonable. I mean, it's really shocking to see a wonderful watch only, you know, at $100 or around $100 plus or minus. But bottom line is they're able to do that because they just cut out the middleman. They're going to direct to consumer, which is a great business model. The watches do start at $95, actually. At a department store, a similar watch would be $400 or $500. So, these are a really, really good value to get here.
Yeah, and what I love about them is that they look great and they fit. You know, I have a really hard time. I have these little tiny wrists and I have a hard time finding watches that fit me, that I can wear, that I think look really chic. So I love that they have great options for both men and women. And guys, there's no hassle. You order online, you get free shipping, free returns, and a 2-year warranty. That's really good.
So guys, go to mvmtwatches.com/skeptics today and they'll give you 15% off your entire purchase. That's mvmtwatches.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to our show. So this is an interesting other technological development. This is Melbourne researchers.
Australia.
Yep. Yep. We were there last year.
Twice.
We were actually only in Melbourne once. We were in Australia twice, right? This is Professor Clive May, a neurophysiologist at the Florey Institute. So they develop. All right, so we've talked on the show multiple times about brain-machine interfaces. The technology is developing really quickly. To give a quick overview, essentially you have some kind of electrodes that can pick up electrical signals from the brain, and those electrical signals are connected to a computer, and the computer can interpret them in order to carry out commands. And what happens is, even over a very short period of time, people or monkeys even can learn to control the cursor on a computer screen or a robotic arm or a wheelchair or whatever the computer can control, turn lights on and off in a home, just with their thoughts alone. The electrodes pick up their thoughts. Our brains can learn that way. We could learn to mentally control a computer. And once you have that, you know, once you can control a computer, then you can control anything a computer control, which is pretty much anything, right? So there are technical limitations to this, technological limitations. There's no real computer limitations at this point. That's not the limiting factor. And the software is working really, really well. The big problem is getting electrodes next to brain tissue. In monkeys, they implant the electrodes. In humans, the researchers have mainly been using scalp surface electrodes. The problem with that is that the skull and the scalp attenuates those signals. It it blurs them out, essentially. And so the resolution is much lower, and it's a lot harder to get a good level of control. The control is much better if you open up the skull and put electrodes on the surface of the brain. There's also lots of other problems. Eventually, those electrodes will form scar tissue, and then that can degrade the signal, so they stop working after a while. And if you implant any computer components, you have to deal with heat and power. So we're technologically, I think we're still a ways away from, like, you know, implanting a computer chip in your brain that takes over function or enhances your function, or that is a remote or a wireless interface, just because of those technological problems. Okay. So what this company did, what these researchers did, is create what they're calling a bionic spinal cord, which is a term that I hate. I think it's completely misleading. It's not a spinal...
You don't like the word bionic?
No, it's just, it's not a spinal cord. I mean, they're calling it a spinal cord because it connects the motor cortex to some device, right? Like the spinal cord connects your brain to your muscles. But it kind of, I think, creates the wrong impression. It's just another method for putting electrodes on the brain.
Yeah.
So what they did was, and this is actually brilliant, I think this is a fantastic idea, they took a stent that is used to be put inside of a blood vessel to hold it open, for example, to open up a blood vessel, and they wrapped electrodes around it. And then what they did is they insert the stent with the electrodes into a vein in the brain that's overlying the motor cortex. So these electrodes now are basically right on the surface of the brain, because it's on a superficial vein that's sitting on top of the brain, right?
And it doesn't, it's not a problem that it's like blocking blood flow in that vessel?
Well, I mean, it is a stent. It's kind of made to allow blood to flow around it. And it's a vein, so who cares? You know, it's not as, it's not like, I mean, if it were an artery, that's when I first read it. I'm like, God, I don't know if I want one of those things in my artery. But then I read the paper and it's like, no, it's in a vein. Okay, okay, that makes a lot more sense.
Yeah.
that it's in a vein. And, but yeah, it's so far those veins where they've tested it have been patent. They stay open. Blood still flows around them. It's a low pressure system. It's a lot easier, you know, than an artery. So this is a way of getting electrodes under the skull, very close to the actual surface of the brain. You can have a high, you know, an array of high resolution electrodes, and there's no scar tissue because you're not cutting through anything. It's a very simple procedure. You know, you don't have to open up the skull. You could, it's a same day procedure. They just go in through a peripheral vein and send it up there. So this is a, this could be a tremendous advance. This could make it very feasible. They're going to be testing it in people in 2017, they say. So this could be a tremendous advance in brain-machine interfaces. And then, of course, they, you know, the reason for the name is because they talk about all the potential applications. I think we've spoken about it on the show before. Again, once you are reading electrodes, you know, reading electrical signals from the brain, and getting those signals to the outside so that you can connect it to a computer, then you can control prosthetics, you can control a wheelchair, you can control the computer. So this, you know, could be a tremendous, you know, medical device for allowing paralyzed people to move, for example. All of those things, every application you could think of once you could read the electrical signals from the brain, which I think is, you know, in the last 10 years, what we've really discovered was that there really isn't any theoretical limit to the degree to which the brain can adapt to having a computer interface.
You mean that the brain will, with its plasticity, will change itself to conform?
Yeah, it's partly plasticity. It's partly just learning. Really, it doesn't even require a whole lot of plasticity, meaning it's not necessarily making new neurons. It's just the neurons are... this is what they do. They can adapt to incoming electrical signals, and this is how you learn. So just like you could learn to shoot baskets, you could learn to control a robotic arm.
It's yeah.
It turns out it's that simple, you know. And
monkeys do it.
Yeah,
like we've seen monkeys do it for years
with precision. With precision.
Yeah.
Steve, I was watching an interesting Netflix anime series recently, and in one episode, a character loses an arm and gets a prosthetic, and the hand looks totally humanoid, but each finger could separate into two distinct halves. That then basically means that she had 10 fingers
and on each hand,
on that one hand.
On that
so
one
she
hand.
She was saying how, you know, how she said it just felt normal that she has 10 fingers on this one hand now. So you're saying that someday people can learn to have like 10 fingers.
Yeah, absolutely. You could have four arms.
Now, Steve, can I control the kitchen chef that Bob's going to put in?
Oh, gosh, yes.
Yeah. So seriously, so that's one of the things that we learned. The brain is remarkably adaptable to controlling things other than just our four limbs. You know what I mean?
That's cool.
You literally could have extra arms and your brain would just control them and could even be made to feel as if it owns them. You know, that it actually feels like a natural part of your body.
Agency. Nice.
Yeah. And the sensory feedback will feel natural. I mean, so far, every component of that loop that we've tested, it's like, yeah, your brain could do that. It'll feel natural. You'll control it. You'll own it. It's fine. You know, it seems like the brain could totally adapt to unnatural body parts.
Imagine having an extra arm like Zaphod. What would that actually be like? And here's a question. If you disconnected that extra arm, would you get phantom pain and would you feel like you've been amputated?
Maybe.
Yeah.
If it was there long enough. Yeah.
Possibly, that the brain gets used to
it. Oh, my
it.
God.
You could have a tail.
People
will have tails. Yeah, I think people will do whatever it takes.
And people are already starting to do weird things where they will like implant a magnet under their fingertips so that when they run their fingers over magnetic surfaces, they feel a little pull. And eventually, I mean, who knows? We may be able to start learning or mapping that kind of sensation into some sort of magnetosense. Like, there's all sorts of interesting things that even though our bodies didn't evolve those kinds of sensors or detectors, our brains might be able to learn how to use them if they are bionic or adaptive.
Yeah.
Which is very weird.
So I think this is a great technology. I think this is I suspect this is going to be a bridging technology, meaning that this would be a great way to get a reasonable number of electrodes next to cortex that we could use, you know, to control devices. I don't think this is going to be the ultimate technology that we go for. I think we're going to have to really invent some kind of, you know, bionic, if you will, electrodes that can exist in the brain without forming scar tissue, without overheating and
nanotech.
You know, yeah, whatever, you know, whatever. But I think that that's the ultimate goal is to make a sustainable interface like that. But this is a great solution for now. I mean, I think this is going to work out really well, is what I suspect.
So, what like appendage would you guys want in addition to what you have?
Oh, I would want eyes that could see in different spectra.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'd want to be able to see infrared or see X-rays or something.
A little bit
like
of
that.
The ultraviolet.
Yeah.
Nice.
Wouldn't you get a lot of headaches and things?
I don't know.
Why would you?
I mean, I would hope that I had enough like neural architecture to dedicate to that. I might have to lose a sense, huh?
That does bring up a good point, though, Evan. I'm sure that we are going to discover all kinds of neurological oddities and side effects.
Sure.
Yeah, like neuropathic pain or triggering migraines or whatever. So there is that possibility as well. What I suspect is that some people will adapt better to it than others, just depending on your, you know, your brain function.
And your age,
Bob?
Your age probably. Well, I just had a thought of being able to focus on two different tasks at once. It doesn't really technically fit into this, I don't think. So maybe I should just come up with something else. But that
would
be
pretty
epic.
So you want a whole new head is what you're saying.
Yes. Zaphod, baby.
Do they have to be exterior? In other words, can I have a extra heart or something in case one goes bad? Or is that
that's different?
So we get
that's perfectly fine with
that's
me.
I think that's
in a different compartment.
It's apples to oranges, I think.
Yeah, this is more of a sensory thing, right? Like, what about a compass? Would you want some sort of compel sense? I just made up the word compel.
Compel.
You know,
is that next?
You know, Steve, she
is that
starts
next
like
word?
This new segment on the show, and she now thinks she can invent words. That's where we're at.
I like it.
I know what it's perfectly. I know what I want. I would want a third leg so I could have my three feet rubbed at the same time.
Ew! Yes. Everything about that, I'm taking the wrong way right
three,
now.
Three at a time.
I do think a prehensile tail would be cool.
But Steve, how about sitting?
Yeah, you kind of lay back.
I think that could be a deal breaker because think about it. Think of the way you're sitting right now. Now put a tail there. That would suck.
No, it just goes, you know, there's a space for it.
So tucks,
think about it.
Up in there.
Well, there'd have to be like an indentation. Oh, there is an indentation.
By Craggy.
By Craggy.
All right. All right. Let's move on, Jay. This is an interesting news item. I'm not sure I buy it. I think it's being oversold. But you tell me about the new method of potentially diagnosing cancer.
There are researchers at VUMC Cancer Center Amsterdam have developed a method of detecting many kinds of cancer, even early stages of cancer, from one drop of blood. I think that's the part you don't like, Steve. From just one single drop of blood, right?
No, that's not my problem with it, but I'll go ahead. You go. I'll tell you what my problem is with it.
All right. So what they do is they take that drop of blood and they smear it on a pentagram and they petition Satan to give them the information. Is that the part you don't like?
I missed that part, I think, when I was reading the press release.
No, they don't actually do. Maybe they do that, but they do other stuff with the blood, too. So today's cancer detection scenarios, whatever you want to call it, they include different kinds of scans, you know, CAT scans, MRIs. You know, they'll also take tissue samples, biopsies. You know, of course, these methods are hugely expensive. They don't give immediate answers in some cases, like biopsies take time for someone to analyze them. And the problem is that the methods that we have today many times are only found when you're in a later stage of cancer, right? So they're going to take pictures of you using a CAT scan or an MRI. Sometimes they can't see it if it's too small. If it's just a very small collection of cells, they can't see it. It has to be a larger mass. And then, of course, the longer cancer is in your body, the more chance it has to metastasize and spread to other parts of the body. So rule of thumb here is the earlier you detect cancer, the much better treatment you can get and the better chances of your survival. So researcher Tom Werdinger, who is the lead researcher and his team at VUMC Cancer Center Amsterdam, conducted a study on more than 200 subjects, and the team figured out that a cancer patient's platelets have unique RNA patterns or markings that come from a patient's cancer itself. The cancer actually changes the platelets. And in case you'd like to know, platelets are special blood cells whose main job is to basically clot. They just they provide a clotting function.
Yeah, and they're actually cell fragments. They're not whole cells.
Right. They don't have a nucleus, right, Steve?
Well, it's not. Well, you're thinking of red blood cells. Red blood cells don't have a nucleus. Platelets aren't even entire cells. They're just little pieces of cells.
Okay.
They're little cell fragments.
And these your platelets typically they're about 1/10 to 1/20 of your blood mass. Right, so they're not all of your blood; they're just a small portion of it. So the RNA markings enable scientists to distinguish between a healthy patient and patients who have cancer. And this procedure has been shown so far to be 96% accurate for most types of cancer. Now they can also determine which kinds of cancer is present and if it has metastasized to other parts of the body, which is great. I mean, if this is true, that's a fantastic thing that their analysis can do. There's six different tumor types that they've so far have tracked. Pancreatic cancer. Steve, help me out here. Colorectal cancer.
Yeah, colorectal.
Glioblastoma.
Glioblastoma. Yeah. That's brain cancer.
Yeah, that's brain, too. Of course. Mm-hmm. Thank you. That's correct. Breast cancer. And yeah. And
you pronounce that
hepatobiliary.
Well?
Hepatobiliary.
Perfect. Exactly. Like blood you can say something. It either way. But the way this Steve says it is correct. Okay. And also non-small cell lung carcinoma. Now, they also said that they can determine the origin of the primary tumor with a 71% accuracy. And I'm pretty sure what they mean is that they can determine the original tumor that started it all, the big one, that other cancers could have spread from in your body. Now, this information, like I said, is gathered from the platelets, and it also can help determine what type of therapy would be the most effective for treatment. And then they can reanalyze the blood afterwards to tell if the treatment is working, and if not, make adjustments and then continue down the pathway to the healthiest treatment. They said that this is an early experimental, but they're hoping that by the year 2020, it's not 5 years, it's less than 5 years away, that they would be able to make a very, very affordable public use version of this that would give fast and accurate answers. So now go ahead, Steve. What do you not like about this?
So let me give you the reality now. So that's all well and good. And hopefully this will pan out to a useful diagnostic procedure. This is not the first time that this news item has existed. I mean, I read about this all the time. A blood test for this, a blood test for that. You know, basically somebody finds a marker in some kind of, some part of the blood that has some correlation with some diagnostic outcome. the question is, and again, the way it's been being reported, I need to look at more technical write-up, because like 96% certainty, that's not a technical term. I need to know the sensitivity and specificity of these tests, and also its predictive value, basically. I need to know if you have a positive test, how predictive is that you have cancer, that you have a certain kind of cancer, and that it's metastasized, which seems very interesting to me that they could determine that. Is it enough that we can actually rely upon it? We could make medical decisions based upon it. If the false positive rate is, even if it's 1 or 2%, which is not a lot, that's they say 96%. Does that mean there's a 4% false positive rate? You think about a 4% false positive rate, and then you test it on 1,000 people as a screening procedure, and only of those 1,000 people, let's say 10, have cancer, you can end up with more false positives than true positives very easily. And then what do you do? What do you do with the positive test, given that you're not sure if it's a real positive or a false positive? Then you have to do a whole body scan. What do you do at that point? And then what are the consequences of doing that? Now we're searching for tumors that would otherwise be too small to detect, or we wouldn't have known about for a year or whatever. So this is really tricky area. It seems fantastic the way they're presenting it, but in the real medical world, when we're talking, you have to ask very serious questions about how exactly would you use this, on what population, what kind of information would it actually give us, and would it be able to actually guide our decision making? And they're extrapolating, they're speculating out their ass when they start. Seriously, just from reading this is just all incredible speculation. This would have to be validated clinically to a significant degree. They say it's in the early stages. That means we have no idea how this is going to play out. Seriously. I hope it works wonderfully. I'd love to be able to just do a blood test and be able to say all sorts of things about what kind of cancer you do or don't have. But it's a lot trickier than this article makes it seem.
I have a question for you, Steve.
Yeah.
So maybe like 2 years ago, maybe not even that long ago, I did a story on my Al Jazeera show, which is sadly going away, about dogs that can smell cancer.
Smell cancer. Yeah. I've read those articles.
And so I went to the university, the UPenn, like canine training center where they train cadaver dogs and things like that. And they were doing these experiments where they would put like rags in tubes that had been soaked through with fluids from cancer patients. And then they used rags that, were had no cancer on them. And the dogs could pretty reliably smell that cancer after like long training sessions.
Yeah.
And so the question is, there are a lot of labs now that are interested in trying to figure out what is the compound that the dogs are smelling. And if they can isolate that compound, then if we produce some sort of a blood test that could potentially, that actually tests for that compound, that could actually be adequate. Do you think that there's a future in that?
Everything I just said applies to that as well. And I see press because I read medical press releases. I see press releases all the time. Sniff test for Alzheimer's disease, smell test for cancer, and it's exactly what you're talking about, trying to isolate an airborne molecule that can be detected and that has some correlation with whether or not somebody has cancer or whatever. These tests have to be put into a clinical context in terms of how sensitive and specific is the information you get back, meaning what the true positive, false negative, true negative rates are, and how would it be used. For every test that's clinically useful, there's dozens, maybe hundreds of tests that are interesting, that produce some statistically significant results, but may not really have a useful clinical application because they're just not at that level yet.
And a lot of people were talking about this could be really interesting in third world countries, in lower income places where they just can't afford to have the high tech kind of testing available. But it's still a little worrisome. Interesting, though.
Yeah.
At first, I went in fully on skeptic. I was like, there's no way dogs can smell cancer. And then I was really impressed by at least those early studies that are happening just where the dogs are looking.
Yeah, it's not implausible that they're smelling something. But again, I don't think that's going to be useful clinically. When you think about it, what's interesting is that if anything, we're kind of pulling back and doing less screening, you know, designed to detect cancer or determine cancer risk early on, like prostate specific antigen, you know, it's starting to become a little controversial for that. You know, who should actually get that test? Is that really a useful screening test to do? Who, you know, there's been a huge controversy over who, you know, where the line is for women getting routine mammograms.
Yeah. And even the BRCA test, like, do you really want to do a mastectomy just because you're positive on your BRCA test?
Screening tests are one of those things that sound fantastic, but are really tricky in the real world, and they could easily cause more harm than good. And a lot of these things are kind of in that category, but they, you know, you never know. I mean, we have to see how it plays out in mature clinical testing, not just these preliminary basic science tests. That's kind of my point. And when it really matures, and it has to really be vetted, and we have to see what is the effect this is going to have on our clinical decision making and our clinical practice. We're not there yet, so we can't say. All right, Kara, the rumors are flying about gravitational waves. What's the update?
Yeah. So, you know, we're recording this show on Wednesday evening. It'll go live on Saturday, as it always does. But tomorrow morning, Thursday morning, a press release is scheduled in Washington, D.C., but also in Paris and London, pretty important, by the team working on the LIGO project. Now, LIGO stands for Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. And I'll get a little more into what LIGO is in a moment. But like you said, Steve, rumors are buzzing. But at this point, it seems pretty obvious to anybody who has covered gravitational wave science before that gravitational waves seem to have been detected. And I know that we'll provide an update and append it if it's needed after the announcement. But I thought a good thing to do here would be a primer of what a gravitational wave is, how we detect them, and what this means for the future of cosmology and astrophysics.
Is it primer instead of primer?
Oh, I always say primer.
I think it's either.
It's either. Good. Thank you for that.
East Coast, West Coast thing.
Yeah, let's call that an LA Texan thing.
I like it.
Or I'll call it a primer just for you, Bob. All right. So what is a gravitational wave? Well, they were predicted by Albert Einstein this year, exactly 100 years ago. And I think a good way to think of it is a vibration in the fabric of space itself. Now, this is a necessary, yet before now, unproven consequence of Einstein's theory of general relativity. See, a lot of times when we think of gravity, we think of it as like an attracting force, but that's not really correct. According to Einstein and most modern physicists, gravity is more like a warping. It's a physical fluctuation in space itself. And when gravitating objects move, they actually make tiny ripples that vibrate through space. No matter where they are, eventually those vibrations should make their way towards us. They might be too small to detect, but they should make their way towards us. And they would actually ripple our own local space through these teeny tiny stretches and compressions that we could theoretically measure. Now, we've been trying to do that for a really long time, actively for about 30 years, but theoretically for the past 100 years since Einstein first described gravitational waves. But the news tomorrow could mean that we finally made those accurate measurements. There's a bunch of different ways we've been trying to measure gravitational waves. One of them is through a newly launched space detector. One of them is through these pulsar timing arrays, so using actual celestial data in order to understand what's happening at these fluctuations of large gravitational objects. But the one that we're going to focus on are the measurements that are made at LIGO. The buzz is that there's been a merger of two binary black holes. One of them is 29 solar masses, one is 36 solar masses, and that as they've been merging, they've produced enough data for our detector at LIGO to measure gravitational waves at a 5.1 sigma detection level, which is just over the 5 sigma cutoff that physicists use to say that this is a statistically significant observation. So what is LIGO and how does it work? Well, according to its website, the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory is designed to open the field of gravitational wave astrophysics through the direct detection of gravitational waves predicted by Einstein's general theory of relativity. It's a multi-kilometer scale gravitational wave detector, or pair of detectors, I should say, that uses laser interferometry to measure the minute ripples in space-time caused by passing gravitational waves from cataclysmic cosmic sources, such as the merger of pairs of neutron stars, black holes, or very large supernova. And LIGO is actually two widely separated interferometers. One is in Hanford, Washington, and the other is in Livingston, Louisiana. So think of it this way. As gravitational waves pass by, or I should say through us, that's an important point because gravitational waves do just kind of go through everything, which is why it makes them really hard to detect. They actually perturb space-time so that it takes slightly longer for time to travel between the two objects because of that alternate compression and stretching. So if you think about it, if you have two things that are, you know, a set distance apart and space physically stretches or compresses, the time that it takes for a signal to go from one to the other is actually going to be different than it would be when the gravitational wave is not passing through. So LIGO is actually this ground-based detector. It's got two locations, as I mentioned, Livingston, Louisiana and Hanford, Washington, and they're 2,000 miles apart, roughly. Inside of each detector, there are these really huge arms. They're like 2.5 miles long each. And they're basically vacuum tubes that have mirrors at each end. And they're lasers that reflect off those mirrors. So what they do is they look for a little blip in the light between one detector and the other. This tiny change in the time that it takes for that light to blip between the two. So a real gravitational wave should be detected by both detectors with this predictable time lapse in between them based on where they have the detectors pointed and what they're trying to look for.
So that means then that these gravitational waves could not by definition travel faster than the speed of light?
They travel at the speed of light from what I understand.
Yeah, I was reading an article that was saying that if they did detect gravitational waves, they could, by detecting them at different points on the Earth, they could determine whether, in fact, they travel at the speed of light, which is I guess what the theory says, or if they didn't.
Yeah, I think it's one of those interesting things where you have to make specific assumptions in order to take your measurements, right? So you make these assumptions that gravitational waves occur at the speed of light, and then you calculate that into your algorithm so that when you're looking for those perturbations, you're making that assumption. Now, if those perturbations did exist, but they came up slightly differently, just like when watch me claim credit here. Just like when scientists at CERN found the Higgs boson, there was an expectation that it would act a very specific way, right? That it would confirm the idea that a Higgs field exists and it would act a very specific way. But maybe they would find something new about it that could change the theory. And that's kind of what we're waiting for. We kind of expect that gravitational waves have been discovered at this point, but the announcement may tell us something that we didn't already know or that we didn't already theorize. So I think the biggest question here for anybody listening who's like, okay, this sounds jargony and I'm not sure why it matters, is what is the significance? And it's actually interesting because it's more than just a better understanding of how space and time actually work. It's more than just confirmation of Einstein's theory of general relativity, although that is a really important outcome if we do directly detect gravitational waves, which we think we have. But this opens up a new field of astronomy altogether, a new way to investigate the universe.
A new field of astronomy. I'm sorry.
Yes.
You said all together. I'm sorry.
It only works if more than one said it.
All together now. 3, 2, 1. Oh, so Kip Thorne, you know, Caltech physicist, yeah. Kip Thorne,
Kip.
Way back in 1987. Thorne. Yeah, famously, you know, Hawking's very good friend, black hole physicist. Back in 1987, he said, quote, "If cosmic gravitational waves can be detected and studied, they will create a revolution of our view of the universe comparable to or greater than that which resulted from the discovery of radio waves." I mean, think about all the things that we can see and do now, you guys, knowing how to harness radio waves and other aspects of the electromagnetic spectra that we can't physically see with our own eyes or with light telescopes. Think about what we've been able to do harnessing them and studying them in the night sky. This could be game-changing. It could be game-changing in how we study black holes, and they could be the next step towards understanding the universe at large. So I'm hopeful. I'm pretty confident at this point, but I'm also really hopeful and excited to hear what the news says specifically.
You know what I always thought was very, very interesting about the idea that gravity is a bend in space-time, right? You know, because it's just a visual. Mm-hmm. Like it's like a bowling ball on a trampoline, right? And it puts that dip in the surface of the trampoline. Where is space-time bending to?
I mean, that's the complicated question, right? We're always looking at...
Where's the negative space it's filling?
Yeah, we're thinking of a four-dimensional model.
Yeah, or is it really just a way to visualize it?
It is. It's just a way to visualize it. You're looking at a two-dimensional drawing that gives you a three-dimensional understanding, but we're talking about four-dimensional space, right? We're talking about space and time.
Yeah, so you basically can't imagine it, Jay, so don't try.
It's hard to imagine, but one of the things that I've seen a lot of physicists saying over and over when they talk about gravitational waves is imagine a lake or a pond, and imagine that you've taken somehow a marker or even a string of buoys, and you've made two parallel lines across that lake that are perfectly parallel, and then you throw a rock into that lake and it starts to ripple. That is the gravitational object producing these shifts in space-time. So as that rock ripples, you'll actually see that those two perfectly parallel lines start to intersect. And where they intersect can help you backtrack and back calculate the size and the shape and the speed and the location of that rock that was dropped into the pond. And that's kind of what they're trying to do with these massive gravitational wave detectors.
Cool.
Yeah, this is Nobel Prize territory. Mm-hmm. This is big.
Oh,
this is,
heavily. You know,
The biggest advance since we discovered that the universe is accelerating its expansion. This is like really upper echelon of awesomeness.
Yeah, this is, I mean, arguably bigger than the Higgs discovery, or at least more meaningful to not just theoretical physicists, but actually experimental physicists. So it could actually have an even bigger effect than the Higgs
discovery. Sure, you could say
discovery.
That. Sure.
Yeah.
Was this the last prediction of Einstein's general theory?
I think so, yeah. Einstein's last prediction to be verified.
Right.
Yeah, major prediction.
Go Einstein.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, come on. I mean, if he's not the uber scientist of all time, I really don't know who is.
And guys, how cool is it that it's happening 100 years? Like,
that's the year after
the prediction.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Right? That is
we like round numbers. Right, Steve?
Yeah. So if we need to make any update before the show goes up after the press release, we will. But I think that is probably going to stand. All right, Jay, it's time for Who's That Noisy?
Who's that noisy?
It's Jay. I think it's Jay.
It.
Did
you
I get it right?
It. Hi.
What do you
get? Last week, I played this sound.
It's an R2 unit with
what
a bad motivator.
That?
Look.
Awesome.
Yes, you're right, Evan. And that is my last Who's That Noisy because I just want to end on a high note. No, that is a very interesting thing. First, a listener named John McLaughlin sent that in. This is the noise of a frozen sea. Specifically, a frozen sea in Russia. The surface of the sea was completely covered in broken ice. And as the water moves underneath it, it's pushing that crust up and down, cracking it. And it's the ice like rubbing against itself and forming new ice, you know, on an order of magnitude more than you probably ever heard ice making noise before because it's a huge area doing it. Very interesting. Now, didn't you guys feel like last week I said this could remind you of something? Didn't it kind of sound like when you walk on snow, that crunchy snow
sound? Yeah, yeah,
yeah. Kind of a creaky noise in there, too.
I don't know.
Okay, snow is this form of precipitation, Kara, that falls from the sky in northern regions of the country.
Tell me
so
more.
So Adam from Chicago guessed that, is that a bird mimicking the sound of a weed whacker?
Whoa.
Adam, no. But please send me more funny guesses, because that was actually kind of funny. So I have a new noisy this week. This week I'm going to say the person that sent it in, Michael Joff Goff, also known as Evil Eye from the message board, sent in a very interesting sound. I think Bob will particularly like this one.
Wow. Chewbacca was really tearing apart whatever the hell that was.
I have a guess. Horrible. I have a guess. It's the noise a terror bird made based on what we know about its anatomy.
That's a cool guess. All right, guys, because nobody really even submitted a good guess last week, I'm going to give you guys a little bit of a hint. That noise you're hearing is actually not an animal.
So what? It's a mineral or vegetable.
Yeah, because those are the only three.
Good luck.
Yeah, that's correct.
Send me your guesses, and please keep sending me in your ideas, because I'm getting a lot of really cool things from listeners, to WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
Thank you, Jay. Quick email this week. It's actually a correction, and we got this from a number of people, so I'm just going to read the correction. So last week on Science or Fiction, we talked about RFID chips, the new unhackable, virtually unhackable RFID chip. And we made a couple of statements, incidentally, that were incorrect. I just made a mental error. I said that RFID was infrared, but it's actually radio frequency.
Oh,
it's
really?
Radio frequency ID, which I know by now.
Oh,
just
wow.
As a brain fart. Yeah, so RFID stands for radio frequency ID.
Yeah, we should have – somebody should have spotted that for
just,
us.
Yeah, just didn't pick up on it.
I should have got that. Oh.
And then – we also talked about the fact that the new chip credit cards use RFID. They don't use RFID. The chip credit cards are physical contact chips. That's kind of the idea, is that they're more secure because there isn't anything that somebody could hack without physically contacting it. But there are near field communications, NFC chips in some cards, and also RFID cards. So I think that might have caused the confusion. But the new credit cards, actually they've been in Europe for decades, but they're new in the United States, that have a chip in them instead of the magnetic strip. Those are contact chips, not RFID chips.
And I hate them because they take forever.
So thank you for those corrections, the dozen or so of you who sent those in. We appreciate it. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, Squarespace.com.
As you guys know, Bob and I have actually used Squarespace to build more than one website. We got intimate with the back end. We love the software because of how easy it is to use. Now, look, I'm a programmer, and I still like to use Squarespace because I just don't have the time to hand build a website anymore. It takes a long time to do it. Would you rather write HTML or just drag and drop the features on your website that you want? You could pick your template. All the templates are responsive, which means that if anybody goes to your website on a computer, a laptop, a tablet, or a cell phone, the website will change itself to fit and look great on all those different platforms.
Yeah, I love that the sites look professionally designed, and it doesn't matter what your skill level is. You can make it look really slick with no coding, and the controls are just very intuitive, very easy to use, and it's really state-of-the-art technology powering your site to ensure that it's secure and stable.
All this, and it only starts at $8 a month. Plus, you'll get a free domain if you sign up for a year. So start your free trial site today, no credit card required, at squarespace.com.
Hey, when you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure to use the offer code SGU to get 10% off your first purchase. All right, guys, let's get back to our show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two genuine and one fictitious. Then I challenge my panel of very relaxed skeptics to tell me which one they think is the fake. No pressure, no stakes, just learning and fun, right?
Just go with it, man.
Whatever happens, it's cool. It's cool.
Cool.
A, B, C.
All right.
Cool.
I know you guys are ready because there's just no pressure. Here we go. Three items, three ordinary news items that anyone could freely access on the internet. Item number one, scientists have identified a new bacterial species capable of causing Lyme disease, the first new such species in North America. Item number two, new research finds that sustained aerobic exercise, but not resistance or intermittent training, increases neurogenesis in the hippocampus of rats. And item number three, researchers find that over the last 1,000 years, cultivation has created crops that are far more hardy and resistant than their wild counterparts. Ah, Kara, first one to make a noise.
Shit. I love that you could recognize my grunt.
Yeah, I don't do it every time, but sometimes I think in my head, all right, first peep I hear.
I love it.
First peep I hear, they're going first.
I don't know why that's so entertaining to me.
Go ahead, Kara.
I've known that for years.
Okay. Yeah, I'm new. Damn it. All right.
That excuse is wearing out very quickly, by the way.
I know, right?
We're coming up on a year, but go ahead.
Oh, my gosh.
That's crazy. All right. So scientists have identified a new bacterial species capable of causing Lyme disease, the first new such species in North America. Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, there's a whole lot of bacteria out there. We can't have discovered it all. Would be big, because then there might be new sources that we didn't know about. But yeah, I think that one could be a fact. Let's see. New research finds that sustained aerobic exercise, but not resistance or intermittent training, increases neurogenesis in the hippocampus of rats. What? Like everything increases neurogenesis. Well, that's not true. But hippocampus, memory, sustained aerobic exercise, but not resist. How do you do resistance training on a rat? You give them like teeny tiny little rat weights?
Little barbells.
Little barbells. It was so cute. I want to see. I need to read this paper now. Let me think. And researchers find that over the last 1,000 years, cultivation has created crops that are far more hardy and resistant. Well, duh. I think that if they're not more hardy and resistant, then like we suck at farming. I'm going to say that sustained aerobic exercise, but not resistance or intermittent training is the fiction. I'm going to say that it's probably more than just aerobic, that like some other types of training also increases neurogenesis in the hippocampus.
Okay, Evan.
Boy, this Lyme disease one, though. A bacterial species? Wow, capable of causing Lyme disease. Capable of causing Lyme disease. Actual Lyme disease or something equivalent that presents, acts, and does everything else like Lyme disease? Is that I'm having a hard time equating this. Okay, I get that they identified a new bacterial species, a new species in North America, okay, but capable of causing Lyme disease? Does that mean we have to rethink the whole Lyme disease thing and how it gets, you know, how people contract it?
These are all very interesting questions, Evan.
That's the most fascinating one of the three.
See, you read them so carefully, and now I'm stressed.
Steve, I'm going to take a pass on this science.
Yeah.
No, I'm kidding.
Are you George Bush? Come on.
Hey, mission accomplished. That's all I have to say. And then, and the 1,000 years of cultivation created crops far more hardy and resistant than their wild counterparts. Sure. Yes. We look. Hey, people have done pretty incredible yet destructive things to this planet. But regardless, I think that one's going to be right. Therefore, I'll say the this Lyme disease one. I don't know. Causing Lyme disease. Yeah. All right. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to flip flop here. I have a feeling. I won't be surprised if that one's going to be the fiction. But I'm going to go with Kara. And I'm going to say it's the rats. And the aerobic exercise one as the fiction. I'm going to wind up being totally, totally surprised by this Lyme disease one. It's going to turn out to be science. So I'll go with Kara.
Okay, Bob.
The Lyme disease, yeah, who knows? I mean, I just don't know enough about Lyme disease to really suss that one out. Sure, I mean, bacteria could do anything. So I'm good with that. The aerobic exercise, I'm going to buy that as well. I mean, sustained, you know, aerobic exercise, you know, you're more cardiovascularly fit. Your ability to transport oxygen throughout your entire body improves over time when you do aerobic exercise. That's why you do it. One of the main reasons. So yeah, I could kind of see it having some sort of impact on neurogenesis. Of course, I could be wrong, but for some reason, this cultivation one's got a stink on it. I could see plants that we have cultivated becoming more edible, maybe more nutritious, but you don't necessarily need it to be hardier and more resistant. You know, if it's a trade-off between just something that you could stomach and enjoy. I just have this feeling that, you know, something that's wilder. Kind of like you see wild dogs. They're not these fancy poodles. I mean, they are just like a totally mixed breed mutt, and they could survive anything. So it's probably a horrible analogy, but I'm gonna go with that. I'm gonna say the cultivation one is fiction.
And Jay,
I agree with Bob. You know, I'm not surprised that there's some bacteria that can cause Lyme disease. I even asked some interesting questions I'd like to know the answers to, but I'll just say, yeah, you know, that's a very good point that Bob made, and I think that bacteria are capable of lots of crazy and insane things. So sure on that one. The second one about the sustained aerobic exercise. So Steve, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't neurogenesis like the regrowth of brain tissue?
Yeah, making new neurons, yeah.
Okay. All right, so this makes, you know, a lot of sense to me as well. You know, increased blood flow, exercise, just overall is the healthiest thing that we can do. You know, with increased blood flow to organs, you know, I think overall cellular health is observable when we exercise. So this last one, Bob didn't like it. I'm not too hot on it either. Let me read what I think the most important line here. So 1,000 years of cultivation has created crops that are far more hardy and resistant than their wild counterparts. So I don't know. I just see a competition all of a sudden arise between 1,000 years of selective breeding and cultivation versus hundreds of thousands or millions of years of random yet slow evolution. So that's the only one of the three that really sticks in my craw a little bit. So I'll GWB and say that one's a fake.
All right, so you all agree on the first one. Scientists have identified a new bacterial species capable of causing Lyme disease, the first new such species in North America. You guys all think that one is science. Before I give you my answer, let me tell you a little bit about the Lyme spirochete.
Yeah, that means that it's science. Go ahead.
Do any of you know the name of the bacteria that causes Lyme disease in North America?
E. Limeus.
Well, what I do know is that it was first found in Lyme, Connecticut, and that's why it's called Lyme disease. Thank you. That's part of, I would say, kind of like my knowledge that I have about Thanksgiving is also kind of folded into there. You know, I used to know the name of it. I forgot, so I can't.
It's Borrelia burgdorferi.
Yep, exactly.
Wow.
Borrelia burgdorferi. Is a spirochete. It's a bacteria. It's actually a spirochete. It's like a spiral shape. Just like syphilis, by the way, is also a spirochete. And the diseases are very similar, actually. They cause a primary infection, a secondary infection, and then a tertiary neurological and, you know, other organ systems can get involved. There are different species that can cause similar syndromes in Europe and other parts of the world. But in North America, Borrelia burgdorferi, that's the only bacteria that causes Lyme disease. However, this one is science because scientists from the Mayo Clinic testing samples from patients between 2003 and 2014 found a small subset, 6 specimens that were different than the Borrelia burgdorferi. They tested positive, but there was just something different about them, and they explored it further. And they identified a new but related species, which they're calling Borrelia mayonii, after the Mayo Clinic. This causes Lyme disease, but there are some slight differences to the regular Lyme disease. The big one is that rather than causing the classic bullseye rash, it causes diffuse rashes. Bacteria are still transmitted through the same ticks, you know, as the regular Lyme disease. This is a tick-borne disease. And this is pretty much isolated to the upper Midwest, Minnesota, North Dakota, and Wisconsin. So it's a regional variant, and it's not just a strain, it's actually a separate species. The good news is if you have this version of Lyme disease, you will test positive with the standard Lyme disease tests. So this is interesting. You know, diseases are always a moving target. Those little buggers evolve. You always got to keep on top of them.
Yep.
Yep. And they respond to the same antibiotics as well, which is good to know.
Okay.
Yep.
Well, there you go.
Okay. All right. Let's go on to number two. New research finds that sustained aerobic exercise, but not resistance or intermittent training, increases neurogenesis in the hippocampus of rats. Jay and Bob, you believe this is science. Evan and Kara, you think this one is the fiction. And this one is.
Say it.
Science.
Yeah, baby.
Oh.
High five, Jay.
Yeah, so it's pretty much, I gave a pretty good summary in that statement there. So there's a new study. So they looked at high-intensity interval training. They looked at sustained aerobic exercise and resistance training.
Sustained.
And then they looked at the number of neurons in the hippocampus of these rats. And in the sustained aerobic group, but not the two other groups, at the end of the 6 to 8 weeks of training, the numbers were significantly increased. Yeah, so it improved hippocampal neurogenesis. So exercise is good for you.
Of course.
And it's still an open question, though, of like interval training versus resistance versus aerobic, you know, and that's what they were looking at here. So this one study favored sustained aerobic exercise.
For that one effect.
For that one effect, yeah. So it doesn't necessarily mean that it's better for cardiovascular health, for weight loss, for muscle tone, whatever. Probably it's a good idea just to
do all three.
Do everything. Just do a little cross training. Yeah. All of this means that researchers find that over the last 1,000 years, cultivation has created crops that are far more hardy and resistant than their wild counterparts.
How is this the fiction?
The fiction is a very good reason why this is the fiction. The opposite is true. Our crops are getting less resistant specifically. Hardy is kind of a vague term, but so yeah. The reason for that is because we're breeding out the toxins that plants use to protect themselves.
Right.
Because they're bitter and they're poisons. So, right? The study that this is something I've known for a while based upon other research, but the study that triggered this was looking at tomatoes. And they found that the wild versions have chemicals in them that defend themselves much better against specific pests. In this case, the whitefly, and that the cultivars that we're growing, you know, commercially these days, while they're bigger, juicier, good shelf life, nice and red, they have less of the natural pesticides in them, and therefore they're much more susceptible to the whitefly, which is why we have to use additional pesticides, right? One interesting thing here is that some scientists calculated, and I think I've written about this before, that 99.9% of all the pesticides you will ever consume in your life are naturally made by the plants that you're eating.
Awesome.
And this is not genetically modified plants. This is how plants protect themselves from pests. They produce natural pesticides, and we eat them, but we have bred them out of a lot of the foods that we eat because they're generally bitter.
But that's why.
You know, nutritionists often say that you need to eat some bitter plants because they do contain a lot of nutrients. And the nice tasting plants that don't have any bitterness in them are also missing some phytonutrients and other things that may not have as broad a selection of nutrients. Right. So you got to eat your arugula, you know, occasionally, I guess.
I hate arugula.
You know, right? Because it's
kale.
Bitter.
Gross.
I like arugula.
Carrot, Kara and I are super tasters, if you remember from a recent episode.
Oh, that's right. You guys are
I like my romaine.
Yeah. But you're still fine. But I wrote about this one before, too, that potatoes produce a chemical called solanin, and that is their main pesticide that they use to fight off insects. In fact, a number of years ago, a company developed a potato that had increased levels of solanin specifically so that it would be hardier and more resistant and you wouldn't have to use as much pesticides. And it worked and it was great, but it was poisonous. People were getting sick from it. They had to pull it off the market because the levels of solanin were too high. So, you know, in order to make this food optimal for us, we've made them more susceptible, and which is why we have to use pesticides.
So in my defense,
yeah.
When I read this, for whatever reason, when I read crops, I was thinking produce. Like, I wasn't thinking while they're still in the ground. I was thinking that over the last thousands of years, we have cultivated crops that could last longer after
life.
They've been.
Yeah.
Yes, they're more resistant and hardy. I was thinking more resistant to bruising, and they're hardier for shipping. Like, I did not even think about disease. So I totally misread this one.
You sure did. Which,
and I was like, that's why I was like, there's no fucking way. Like, I was so upset when you told me. Because, yes,
but it makes sense now, right?
Yes, it makes total sense now. But crops are, or I should say produce, is way hardier and more resistant than it used to be. I mean, a lot of produce used to not even be edible.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. That's why, yeah, specifically with the term resistant in there, because that has a very specific meaning, you know. It does say, crops. But and hardy, you could argue
and
that
it
because
does say crops.
Hardy, you could think, because I do think we did create cultivars that are more drought resistant and that are adapted to the environments in which we're growing them, but not resistant. They're more vulnerable to pests, definitely.
Interesting. Yeah.
So good job, Bob and Jay.
You.
I don't know why I made that noise.
Jay?
That was me. I don't know why I made that noise. That
little lackluster.
That was Bob's first win. Bob's first win in like 3 weeks.
Actually, no, I'm doing fairly well.
All right, Evan, give us a quote.
So tonight's quote. I found this, so I'm going to credit myself for having found this. Education has failed in a very serious way to convey the most important lesson science can teach. Skepticism. Ooh. Oh, yeah. Indeed.
Who said that?
Said by David Suzuki, Canadian academic, science broadcaster, and environmental activist.
Yes, yeah, I know him. He's cool.
Yeah, he is cool.
Obviously.
You know, hey, look, skepticism, science, they deserve to be, you know, taught together. They're hand in glove.
Skepticism.
So they are. They are quantumly entangled, one might argue.
I love that.
Bob, thank you.
Science and skepticism are quantumly entangled, Evan Bernstein.
Yes, I got a quote.
Soon it'll be a bumper sticker
or a T-shirt.
I'm trying to think of the ramifications of that.
So, thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it, brother.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Thanks, Doc.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at theskepticsguide.org, where you will find the show notes as well as links to our blogs, videos, online forum, and other content. You can send us feedback or questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. Also, please consider supporting the SGU by visiting the store page on our website, where you will find merchandise, premium content, and subscription information. Our listeners are what make SGU possible.